this is a more credible, believable computation and estimate of the actual economic losses. I mean, forget the moral and beauty and aesthetic losses.
Right.
You're going to lose $38 trillion a year.
Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin Mass FM radio dial, 102.9. Here today in our glorious radio studio with our my climate guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, how are you doing this fine Tuesday?
I am doing wonderful, Steve. It's great to be here at the end of April, at the end of Earth Month, where we all think about our fondness for Mother Nature, and here we are.
Yes. It was a busy weekend. If folks may recall, there was a whole bunch of Earth Day activity scheduled for Saturday the 20th. We had a deluge, so they got rescheduled to the 27th. It was much better, much nicer weather. Ryan Jetty, our recreation director, actually, who also should get kudos because he's coming up on his 25th anniversary in September as a town employee. 24 years ago, this April, he started the first Earth Day in Franklin.
Really?
Thank you, Ryan.
That's great. That's great.
It's been a good run. He had 60-odd people pre-register for the event. He had over 200 show up.
Really?
So as we kind of did some back-of-the-napkin math, you know, there was at least 300 people out and about doing something, cleaning up, understanding, seed, roll and strolling, whatever, on Earth Day here in Franklin. At a minimum, 300.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, the Earth Day, to my mind, speaks to sensibility among all, you know, mm-hmm. just do a lot of other things. I mean, it's just this sort of a reminder to take a moment, sort of like Christmas, right? You say, oh, Christmas, peace and love all year long, and people walk away. But at least once a year, you recognize in April the ephemeral and beautiful nature of the planet that we're on. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing to do.
Especially as specifically in this particular arena, the buds are starting to pop. We're starting to, the trees, which had been skinny and bare, are now starting to fill out. In a couple of weeks, they'll just be, you know, shade trees again.
Yeah.
There's all goodness there.
Shade trees are good for you.
They are reducing temperature and absorbing CO2, which is one of the things that we're looking at. Yeah. And yes, wetlands, and I know our conservation agent, Brekeli Goodlander, she loves to be in the water, even if it's gooky, mucky stuff. But as we learned from back in that episode, that swamp wetlands actually can capture more CO2 than a tree. Yeah. So kudos for the wetlands.
Yep. Wetlands are good for us.
Wetlands are good for us, yes.
Oh, let me put it this way. What's good for the wetlands is good for you.
Yes. Because, oh, by the way, this is one Earth. And we're on it. Thank you, listeners, for joining us on our journey to help me make sense of climate. And Ted is our guide. And you've got a few links we're going to kind of noodle through today.
Yeah, that's, so one of the things that came up this week is a little bit, it's not actually a couple of weeks ago, is somewhat esoteric, abstract, and dry, but it is, at some a different level, important, chilling, especially if you're of a certain age. And that's it's a study done in Europe, but it's a study where really smart people, economists mostly, took a look at the economic impact of climate change over the last 40 or so years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all the discussion of the method, you know, of all this. And it's a credible thing, right?
Yeah.
Put that aside for the moment.
But even in putting it aside, that kind of explanation of the methodology, the data capture, the data gathering is important for transparency.
Yes, yes. How did you get
Absolutely that? Important. Because then people can replicate that data, and yea, verily, it should come out close in the ballpark as opposed to being, where did they come from this?
So, but the long and short of it is, after looking at historical losses due to things that are climate related and projecting those forward, because you can correlate it with what climate change has been and what is going to become, mm-hmm. these folks concluded that by the year 2050, okay, which is now, what, 26 years from now?
It's rapidly approaching.
It's rapidly approaching.
More rapidly than we'd like.
that the impact of climate change will amount to a loss of $38 trillion a year to the global economy. $38 trillion a year lost because of climate impacts. And that, what I was reading was an article by Bill McKibben. And Bill McKibben says $38 trillion. Is that a lot of money? So the question is that...
That's a big number.
It's a big number. It turns out that I've got it here somewhere, is that the entire world economy at the moment, okay, here in 2024, the entire world economy is $100 trillion a year.
So 100 trillion versus 38
trillion loss.
That's like one third.
That's a huge amount.
Yeah, that's right? One third.
And if you assume that between now and 2050, that 100 trillion that were the global production this year, that's going to increase, at some rate, right?
Yeah.
What it turns out is that there's essentially, I think it's a 19% loss of the global domestic product, the GDP for the world. I'm not sure how that makes sense, domestic for the globe, and we're not selling it to the moon or anything. But I mean, a 20% loss of economic activity in the year 2050, which is enormous.
Right.
Enormous. And that the article points out that it hits certain places hardest, but that North America and Europe are also going to be hit.
Mm-hmm.
What it's saying is that strong income reductions, right? Income, and you think your paycheck, right? Strong income reductions are projected for the majority of regions, including North America and Europe. So, I mean, this sort of gets into a classic thing. I mean, much as I hope the contrary, I may not be here in 2050, mm-hmm. right? But my son will be here. My grandchildren will be here, right?
Sure.
And so you got to start to think that this is serious, serious stuff. And so, I mean, that's just a number that there. This is a more credible, believable computation and estimate of the actual economic losses. I mean, forget the moral and beauty and aesthetic losses.
Right.
You're going to lose $38 trillion a year. And that will have a distinct impact on lifestyle mm-hmm. and how people live their lives.
Well, and I think in so many other words, so we almost wake up, if not once a week, a couple of times a week, where some other extreme weather event has just transpired, whether it's tornadoes through Oklahoma or fires in Canada or floods in Kenya.
Or Dubai,
of all places. All of these events clearly have economic impact. Clearly those, and it's tragic, of course, because as the tornado goes through, it just, makes, not to pinwheels, but splinters entire buildings and cities and towns. And the recovery, people's lives have stopped. And then now they need to recover, assuming they can. Will insurance cover some of that? At some point in time, we've seen, especially with kind of the coastals, the insurer is going to back off from those if they haven't already, because it's no longer insurable for them. They know they're just going to lose money, so they're not going to insure anybody.
And I mean, the point being that once your house is knocked down, your productivity goes way down. So this is what the economists are looking at. That's a loss to say now your house is knocked down.
Right.
You can't earn the money that, you know, your livelihood is lost. That's in the $38 trillion.
So that's what I was getting to. So all these events, somebody's calculated that these events, and then extrapolated for, you know, through 2050. This is the economic impact for all these events around the world, et cetera. That's a staggering number. Never mind, to your point, the other moral factors, the other life cycle factors, the other, you know, beauty that's lost in some cases. You know, if it hits an old architecture, et cetera, that's gone.
Yeah. Well, in the article suggested that, or the commentary on the article suggests that even this $38 trillion is number of estimate of the loss is a conservative. Could be more.
It could be
because
well.
Of. It's not this calculation is a sort of economics. It doesn't take into account sort of catastrophic political events that would come about because of the stresses
right.
of all these bad things that are going to happen. But then, so this article from McKibben, I thought it was pretty cute, or not cute, it was very thought-provoking. It, you know, $38 trillion is a lot of money. You say, well, you know, what can you do about this? And part of what he's saying is it's time to get past capitalism, which of course immediately marks you as some sort of nutcase. You say we need to move past capitalism.
How are we going to do that?
Well, yes, and for the moment we're stuck with this buggy that we're riding called right. capitalism, right? But a very interesting point that McKibben makes in the article where he is commenting on this other study, but saying that most large companies like Amazon, Microsoft, the majority of the greenhouse gases that are attributed to those companies come from the money that is held in the banks for them, that the banks then reinvest in fossil fuel things.
Right. That was an article we had in a prior session or two where the 80-20 rule, I think, and then there was another link within that that said the banks, if we stop these next number of banks
right.
from funding the bad work that's being done, that would be one way of attributing it.
Well, what he says is that if the largest banks, if you reconceptualize where the carbon dioxide is coming from, okay, because
mm-hmm.
you can assign it all kinds of ways,
sure.
right? But I mean, it turns out that the banks and asset managers in the U.S., if that was a country on its own, it would be the third biggest carbon-emitting country in the world.
Sure.
In the sense that all those banks own pieces of all these oil rigs that are going to sell mm-hmm. you all this carbon. And that it's – what the point that McKibben makes is that companies like Apple, Amazon, they're in it for the long run to make money, right? But looking out in 2050, their customers are going to be poorer. Hmm. They're going to have 20% less income if we're lucky that they're there, right?
Right.
And so McKibben says Amazon should be pushing and Apple should be pushing Congress to take action on this now because it's in the long-term interest of Apple to have customers that can buy their phones and their technology.
With the wherewithal to actually spend the money in those companies' ways, yeah.
And I
think it hits on one of the themes we've talked of before is that many of us certainly currently have focused on kind of, well, what's my short-term decision? I need to do this. I'll do this today, as opposed to what's really the long-term implication, right? So even, oh, I'm hungry, I'll have a hamburger. If we have had one less hamburger, then there's implications down the road because of the methane, et cetera, and all that kind of good stuff. But, and, you know, having a salad, perhaps, then we also get some health benefits, et cetera. So it's those kinds of making a long-term decision with a short-term choice and having that become a regular decision model as opposed to, you know, you do it as a study, but then you kind of put it up on the shelf and forget about it.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting segue to a couple of other topics. So, one of the take-home lessons of this $38 trillion study is that you need to be thinking about the future. You need to think long-term. That there are clear clearly definable consequences for what we're doing now. And it's, this is just cataloging the economic ones, right? But then, and we touched on capitalism, put that aside for a minute. We're making decisions in real time now. And one of them has to do, one of the decisions that's in front of us as we speak is that there are bills in the Massachusetts State House that talk about climate stuff.
Sure.
And one of, and there is currently some format of a bill, which I'm sure we'll talk about again before July.
Yeah.
It's going to come around in July in its final format. But it's what's called an omnibus bill that is a conglomeration of a lot of different individual concepts of things that can be done around climate and address to climate. That's a good thing. Massachusetts is a leader. We support that omnibus bill. It's great. But for better or worse, there's a parallel story that I got to tell.
Mm-hmm.
In about 2008 or 2009, there was a move to begin to build a power plant in outside of Springfield that burned wood, or what is called biomass.
Funky word for wood.
Right? This plant would be near what we now recognize as environmental justice communities, or places or neighborhoods that have had all kinds of bad stuff already in there, and then we can put more stuff because it's already junked up. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the unfairness of the whole thing. This power plant has been through ups and downs from the 2010 vintage. A couple of years ago, the legislature passed a law saying biomass cannot be counted as a green fuel, as a good thing, right?
Right.
So, fine. We thought that the zombie had been put to bed and it was all going to go away.
It's come back with another life.
Our little cat feet, this tiptoed back into the omnibus bill, a proposal to re-legitimize biomass as a legitimate clean fuel, to call wood a clean fuel.
Hmm.
And that's an unfortunate thing. There's a movement, people at a place called Elders Climate Action, you can Google it, are pushing to take this little segment, this tiny little segment out of the omnibus bill.
Right.
Because burning wood puts carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it puts soot into people's lungs. I mean,
right.
You know, it's not great. So that, the reason that we went from the $38 trillion to this is because we're making a decision now for something that's going to last for 50, 60
years.
It's going to be well past 2050 that such a biomass-powered power plant would be running outside of Springfield. And we just shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Full stop.
Yeah, that's that, you know, $64,000 question, and probably $64,000 is not the appropriate dollar amount associated with. But the theme is towards that end that, yeah, how do we get in this capitalistic, free moving economic society where you look at the gains and you look at the losses and you make a decision? How do we get, and we've started talking about that, and there's still the effort to kind of reduce carbon, but then carbon, to include the cost of carbon into the decision points so that it now more fairly appropriately sets up for a decision to be made, including that long-term factor as opposed to just the short-term factor. I'll have the burger today. The fact that a cow is expoiling it, you know, it gets us into that longer range.
Right.
But yeah, the insidiousness is one way of putting it, but society, well, even basic physics, an object in motion is going to stay in motion. The economy has been such fossil generated for so long, trying to stop and then turn that ship, that's going to be hard.
And I think, I don't know if we discussed it here, but there's this idea of the of critical path in sociology where you've already got all this fossil fuel stuff, so the easiest thing is just to keep that going. Whereas if you make a decision now, next time around, if you make a decision to use clean energy, then the next thing is easier to accomplish because you've started down a different path.
Yeah.
So that's one example of the $38 trillion, we got to think about the future. Oh, what in the present is related to that $38
tying
trillion?
Tying back, at least from the big world picture, back to Massachusetts, at least, if not Franklin directly. But, you know, we're part of that. So there's...
So the
that
other
makes
one,
sense.
The other one, the other sort of real-time example, I mean, this stuff, it makes discussing the climate stuff interesting because there are real concrete things happening now that we see have this consequence, and it's interesting to think about. Here's the question. Well, I got to set it up first, right? Everyone has driven into Boston on the Mass Pike,
mm-hmm.
right? You go in the Mass Pike, you get past the Cambridge exit, and then the Mass Pike takes a big zag to the left and a big zag to the right. It's right near BU.
Right.
If you look
right.
off to your
it's
right.
Like it's kind of like an S-curve. You make one turn to get to the Cambridge exit, then you make the turn to get into the BU piece. But yeah, yay verily, there was this other lot of land that I guess Harvard owned.
Somebody owned. So what the setup as it is now is that the Mass Pike is pushed over really close to the Charles River.
Yes.
The sacred, love that dirty water, right? Right mm-hmm. close to the Charles River. And there's barely room to walk along the Charles. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think the Storrow Drive goes by this.
Storrow
Drive.
It's
all crowded in,
before,
right?
Yeah.
And you can't walk, but you could drive two cars on Storrow and then the Mass Pike. Along comes Joe Biden, the Infrastructure Act. Tons and tons of money to do the right thing, to rebuild the country. Absolutely sign on. But then what that does is it puts, there is currently a whole lot of money available to rebuild that section of the Mass Pike, mm-hmm. which has been needing a rebuild for probably 20 years.
Right.
Which is good, right?
Yep.
And the climate question is, what do you do? Do you build a four-lane highway in 2024 to take gas cars into Boston and basically crowd the Charles River, forget about the Charles River, so that in the year 2050, when we're talking about $38 trillion of damage each year, we can all drive we have four abreast driving into Boston? Is that what you want to do? Or do you want to have the Mass Pike be narrower, have more space for the Charles River, you know, the greenery on the Charles River? So there's all kinds of questions about what to do with this I-90 section of the Mass Pike in Alston.
Alston, Brighton.
And the reason it keeps choking up is because every time you drive in, at least from our part of the world, you go through it, you see it. You know it's kind of weird because there's no reason to having this zigzag mm-hmm. Through Boston. But the proposals are to build what amounts to a business as usual, keep building it for cars, mm-hmm. and it's going to be there for 60, 70 years.
Right.
And, I mean, I would submit that's not the best idea, but there you go. That's just me, climate guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there have been other iterations of the proposals. Clearly, there was also, and even if we go further on the Mass Pike, even the 495 interchange, which is being redone, ostensibly to be making it much more safe because it has been a frequent accident piece. That's another story. But the money being spent there, I've seen some posit that it would actually make more sense to have, you know, more rapid transit electric vehicles to handle that traffic, safer, more efficient, electric, and oh, by the way, less money that would cost to actually retrofit the auto structure that would then be there for another, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. So,
you're right. I mean,
yeah.
it's a great topic of conversation because it's a way into the questions of what are we going to do at the societal level and how much do we really care mm-hmm. about climate issues and how do we plan the future? If we don't think about it and plan the future, it's just going to be something,
right?
And it'll be, I just guarantee everyone that the future is not a linear extrapolation of the present. It's going to be different. Right? And yeah. So we need to think differently.
Yeah. And that's the major piece because then it comes back kind of to that, critical path. At which point does that first decision make the most sense? Offhand, I would say kind of mass transit in terms of whether it's MBTA trains or buses or subway, if we had that infrastructure in place, then everything else would make a whole lot more sense, because then cars and buses and trucks, certainly today in the fossil world, we can electrify them, but they still occupy space. They still require transit. But if we were able to take a good chunk of it and call good, you know, 10, 20, 30% of that away and go mass transit, that's changed the equation completely. But how do we get to that point?
You're right. I mean, you music to my ears, man. I agree with you. It's just, if you magically turn every car into an electric vehicle, you still need the roadways, you still need the parking, you still have the same mm-hmm. structure of the city that you have. You don't have like walkable cities, you have parkable cities.
Right.
And one thing that I hadn't realized about electric vehicles. So electric vehicles tend to be heavier than gas-powered vehicles.
Because of the batteries.
Because of the battery, right? And because it's a heavier car, when you brake, you tend to erode the tires differently. So electric vehicles have tires designed for electric vehicles, right? Because the erosion is different. But, so here's the kicker, that erosion still, the particles that come off tires, tiny bits of rubber are still damaging to the people who breathe them.
Oh, sure.
Right? And so it's not as if, I mean, electric vehicles are great. Fine. But I mean, there's still issues. It's not perfect. There's still issues. And somebody's got to breathe that junk. And if you're driving in your electric vehicle down the I-90 corridor in Austin, you're still sucking in the microparticles of tire wear. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, there you go. Mm. You are.
So. Yeah. Interesting discussion points.
So there's those two. But then I'll give you hopefully something a little bit more hopeful.
Okay.
Something more upbeat. And this has to do with, again, systemic change, right? Big things. This is, we're not talking about, you know, eating one less hamburger a week here. We're talking about, you know, how do we decide we want to do things? The Biden administration quietly, effectively, maybe it's a little bit sleepy, you can't pay attention all the time, but yeah, it's, they're doing stuff. So, the EPA in the last month has made two sort of important promulgated sets of rules. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's a fancy way of saying they put out a bunch of regulations about what you can and cannot do. Okay,
yep.
These are probably going to get challenged in court. It's going to go blah, 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 go to the Supreme Court. You know, there's a whole sad tale there. But bottom line is that the EPA has essentially set out a rule that by the year 2039, effectively all of the coal-powered power plants in the country will be shut down. And they do that by basically limiting the pollution. Like they put in rules that there's decreasing amounts of carbon dioxide that can come. So coal, mm-hmm. when you burn coal to make electricity, it's horrendous. There's a lot of carbon dioxide comes out of it.
Right.
A lot of mercury comes out and kills the kids that live next door, mm-hmm. right? A lot of toxic ash that builds up and poisons the streams around. So by limiting those things, it basically made it impossible for the coal plants to continue operation. And so they will essentially be out of business by the year 2039. There's two things. One is that it's very interesting, these new rules. There are about 200 coal-powered plants in the United States cranking out electricity from coal, mm-hmm. okay? Mostly in the Midwest, right? But 200 power plants. Of those 200, 25% are scheduled for their end of life within the next 5 years.
Okay.
Right? So a coal plant, you build a coal plant, it roughly lasts 60 years, okay? So 25% of the plants were built 55 years ago. And so this is a perfect time to say, yeah, okay, you need, I mean, this is to keep going. You're going to have to, you know, be better at your game, so to speak.
Right.
And what happens is these coal plants, as they reach the end of their life, they get replaced with something else.
a la solar, wind, whatever.
Whatever's competitive, and there you go. I mean, that's excellent that the administration has done that. It raises a different, just a side topic, which again, as sort of a geek, I mean, but there's this concept you will hear. It's called carbon capture and sequestration, okay, CCS. And the idea is that the people who own the coal plants will say, oh, yeah, we're going to have technology to capture all that carbon dioxide coming out of the smokestack. We're going to put it in a bottle. We're going to take it over. We're going to find an old coal mine. We're going to pump it all into this old coal mine. It's going to be out of the, you know, it's not going to pollute the air. Everything's going to be clean. We're going to keep running coal. And all that carbon is going to be captured and sequestered underground. And life is good. That is a possible mechanism by which these coal plants could stay alive, keep running coal, if they have a carbon capture and sequestration process. Technology process.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Problem is that's the CCS technology doesn't work. It ain't going to work. It's not going to. There's a lot of talk about it. It's like, oh, this is the great future we could have, but it's not going to work. And this is going to put that to the test. I mean, if they can't get this CCS technology by 2039, then everybody's going to shut down. It's a good thing.
Well, even if you did try to capture it in something simple, pull it into a balloon, right, and you just store all the balloons underground, at some point in time, what happens to those balloons? Aren't they going to pop? And isn't that air going to come back up? just an image to play with, you know?
Well, I mean, it's yes, the idea that you're going to pump carbon into the ground at high pressure and it's going to stay there for 10,000 years is, I don't believe. And the reason I don't believe that is because my background is in nuclear physics. So now if you go back to the 70s and 80s, there was a plan to drill into the salt flats in Nevada somewhere, a big hole in the ground, a big tunnel. And they were going to put all the nuclear waste in there,
right.
The Yucca Flats. Yucca Flats, right?
Yep.
And it was going to last for 10,000 years. They'd done all the studies. And as they were drilling this salt mine, all of a sudden the water starts to leak in the salt and just corrodes the salt. So the thing didn't last 10 years, much less 10,000 years. And so the idea that carbon capture and sequestration is going to work and we can all keep burning coal, let's just say I'm skeptical.
Are you from Missouri, the show me state?
I think so. Metaphorically, I am. It's just, man.
Show me.
Yes. Yeah. So there's one. So the administration, this rule that will eliminate coal plants is a good thing. The rules also apply to existing natural gas plants making electricity.
Okay.
But the administration backed off. So here's the fly in the ointment. The administration backed off from making new electrical plants powered by natural gas. They don't have to follow these rules. They say, well, why would you make such an arcane distinction? And it's because certain Democratic senators pushed back and didn't want that happening in their state. And so Joe Biden is trying to navigate this.
Make a deal.
Make a deal, right? Which, dear listener, means, again, reinforces why you need to vote on environmental issues. Please vote for the environmental candidates.
Right.
But so that's the EPA coal thing is a net good. It's a big deal, as Joe Biden would say, a BFD all on its own, okay?
Right.
The other thing that has happened in the last month or so is that the EPA has essentially regulated mileage standards for automobiles, okay, which has happened in the past. This goes all the way back to the 70s, right?
Sure.
Something called CAFE standards, the combined average fuel efficiency for your automobiles. And dear listener, the CAFE standards are why everyone now drives a truck, because the trucks don't fit into that combined average, right? There's a loophole, blah, 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 blah. But the administration has basically set up incrementally ratcheting up the needed mileage so that they estimate by the year, I think it's 2035, that half of the cars on the road will be electric.
Okay.
Right, which is a big step, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And again, the administration has, I mean, I think it would happen faster, but it's going to push that because of the mileage standards that are imposed.
Yeah, well, we've talked in prior sessions too, and I'm sure we'll talk, come back again, because it's one of those things that on the one hand, electric's a good thing. I've got a hybrid, so I don't need to charge because it's charging while I go. But those who have the pure electric need to charge, and there aren't enough charging stations. So you've got the, you know, the range anxiety, which, to coin the term, our state rep Jeff Roy uses as his blog to talk about his range anxieties, and he's had some other contributions to that, from what I understand. So I have to go catch up on other people sharing their range anxiety stories, because yeah, that's a thing. If we don't have as prevalent around us the equivalent of the gas stations that are seemingly on every corner, that kind of transition to electric is going to be that much harder.
I'm looking here. Let me see if I can find it. I saw an article, Steve. We haven't discussed this prior. I saw an article that said, that lamented the fact that American technology is being lost to China. And in particular, I'm going to try and find it here. In particular, what they were saying was that there is a Chinese company that has announced what they regard as a practical car battery that will take you 1,000 miles.
A practical car battery. So theoretically also weighing less than the current ones.
So Chinese battery developer unveils a new technology with a 1,300-mile range.
Wow.
Yeah. And now, whether or not you oftentimes see
show
these articles,
show me
the technology, right, before I buy into that too much. But it just tells you that the capability, the work on the technology across the board, battery just being one tiny segment of all the green technologies, right? This stuff is ongoing. It's, we should be sinking money, you know, throwing money at these this research to, because if you get to a 1,000-mile battery, that's a good thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in my hybrid, I get a 400-mile range. So, I mean, that I'm not driving that much. I only use the car generally on rainy days in Franklin, and then for the trips outside of Franklin as much as I can. I'll walk within Franklin to the extent that I can.
There's no gas-powered car that goes 1,300 miles on the gas. Nothing. Right?
Nothing.
So,
no.
So,
no.
Anyway, the technology, it's an interesting technological race to how you're going to do it.
Right.
And it just, since we're on to geeky technologies, I saw another article that I believed, well, not that I believe less, but it goes into the whole question of cement.
Yes.
Okay. So to make cement, there's a lot of carbon dioxide emissions in making cement, right?
The manufacturing process, yes.
And most modern cement, called Portland cement, decays within 2 or 3 decades. It breaks down.
Sure. Right?
But then you look and say, oh, over in Rome, they have this thing called a Colosseum that's made out of concrete that's been there for 2,000 years. How come?
Why did they do that? Yes.
And so there's a company, I think it's MIT-related company, that is proposing some kind of algae that they mix into the cement. And then when the cement cracks, the algae comes to life and fills up the crack in the cement.
So it's kind of like a living organism within the cement?
Show me, please. But again, it's back to the sort of when the human mind starts thinking about these funky questions.
Right.
And if you could have cement that lasted longer, you would have a carbon dioxide reduction because you wouldn't be repairing things, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the other links, and I think we started talking about it before, we hadn't determined whether it would include it or not, but there was a TED Talk that I found, so I will include the link in there. I wasn't able to validate the charts that they actually showed in there, so I do want to do that, and if I find them, I'll include that in the notes. But at least the TED Talk itself gets to kind of the summation of what we're talking around here, too, is that we're on a roadmap. Certainly there's an international United Nations plan, et cetera. We've got a mass roadmap. Franklin's the green community trying to do its pieces. How do we really track that, right? So there's this group that within TED, at least based on the video, they're starting to do some tracking. And the two key takeaways in the few minutes that I saw of it, and I hadn't completed it, but that's okay. We have the technologies today to solve most of the problems, and most being the key. So we can get to a 2050, we can get to like 2045, we can get there with technologies we have today. But we also need some funding to fund that additional research and or additional technologies to get us that next step, which is not yet available there. And that's why going back to the funding that's in kind of the Amazon and Microsoft's, you know, their funding bucket, but is being used in the fossil fuels. We need to rearrange that so it funds the better stuff so it can help us solve it. And the other piece that was I took in kind of as the hopeful piece, the temperature change, you know, was projected to be, you know, so we've reduced it according to this particular video. So instead of being 3.9, we're going to be 2.7.
This is after we've, in the long run.
In the long run. So we have made progress, which is the key takeaway there. So there is hope. We have made progress. Are we there yet to the new world, which would give us the much more sustainable piece? No, we're not there yet. But the work that we're doing has indeed produced some things that shows we are making progress. Right. So that, at least, is my helpful takeaway, that as hard as it is, and we've discussed here, left-hand, right-hand regulations don't necessarily agree with each other. This is hard stuff. But we are making progress. We have to just kind of re-energize ourselves to continue to make the progress.
And the way you do that is by voting. It's critical that you vote for people who recognize the importance that you hold as a voter, that the value that you place on this stuff, mm-hmm. you want to see reflected in the people that you vote for. That's a closing statement.
That's one key takeaway. Well, thank you for spending a few minutes as we navigated this journey through a bunch of links, a bunch of topics, some of which we've covered before, some of which are still new, and some of which I'm sure we'll still come back to. And dear listeners, hopefully you're still with us. If you've got other questions or topics or conversations we should be having, certainly our contact info is in the show notes. Let us know. Thank you again, sir. I appreciate
always a pleasure,
your
Steve.
Guidance as we navigate this journey to help me make a better sense of science and better sense of climate, because it's here. And as we close again with this one Earth, one month, April, hopefully May, flowers will bloom and won't get ravaged by a tornado or some other extreme event. Oh, fingers crossed. And a quick final reminder for our listeners, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.